Phil Clutton is out there for height purposes. Salt Lake needs to score. Jordan Kerr with 11 seconds back for Jorgensen. Chad Jorgensen launches a backhand toward the end zone. This is going to be the game. Joel Clutton battling for position. He tips it to the end zone where it's caught by Elijah Jaime at the buzzer to tie the game. Incredible awareness from Clutton, and we've got overtime tonight here in the Twin Cities. Unbelievable.
A stunned crowd in complete disbelief. Joel Clutton, he tried it earlier.
Some wild symmetry in terms of Jeff Babbitt, end of third quarter buzzer beaters, 2019 against Dallas. He caught a long shot from Harper Garvey as Antoine Davis may have just clinched the championship weekend MVP award with that block in the end zone.
Antoine Davis with the D.
This New York franchise has redefined excellence. And for the third time in 4 years, the New York Empire are AUDL champions. The dynasty continues for New York.
Welcome back. It's championship weekend swing pass recap time. I'm Adam Ruffner. That's Daniel Cohen. We have just completed the entirety of the 2023 season. And of course, the underdog New York Empire win their second straight championship title. Their third and fourth years completing a 30-game consecutive win streak, tying the 2013 and 2014 Toronto Rush for the longest win streak ever, fully capping what I feel has to be a dynastic run for this New York team. They completely swept out the competition once again at championship weekend for the second consecutive year on the way to winning another title. Their defense was dominant yet again. We will get into the particulars of that. Antoine Davis comes away with the championship weekend MVP for his stellar matchup defense throughout the weekend, just leading the charge of what has to be historically the best coverage unit of all time, going two plus lines deep. They get bundles of breaks and actually outscore the New York offense for the entire weekend. But in addition to New York's greatness, there were bunches of other moments of excellence throughout the final three games of the season, obviously culminating in Saturday night's second semifinal between Salt Lake and Minnesota that went to overtime for just the second ever time at championship weekend. Salt Lake, of course, coming out with a win in the clutch of that one, moving on to a championship game only to get dusted by the Empire, as seemingly every opponent does in this late season format. Daniel, that was a hell of a weekend. I had a ton of fun. I know there's kind of this feeling, I feel like, in talking with people over the last couple of days of, yeah, yet another New York title, woohoo, yeah. You know, like, we all kind of saw this from the beginning. They've been at the top of the power rankings since the beginning of the 2022 season. Haven't been displaced once. Again, 30 straight wins. This team has been a front runner for forever. But as Jack Williams said in the pregame press conferences on Friday before any of the games had started, this is a team that gets only hungrier with each win. And you really see that on display yet again in the two biggest matchups of the year for them. They just completely separate themselves from the competition, not only through their imposing nature, but also through their execution. And it's just, to me, it's kind of a marvel, right? Like, we've never seen a team like this, or even approaching this on a competitive level in this league. They are simply putting themselves head and shoulders above the competition, and they're really just kind of owning it in a way that they own themselves. I mean, you and I were down on the sideline in the final moments of that championship game on Saturday night and just seeing kind of the brotherhood, the camaraderie of all those New York players on the sideline. I mean, they were emotionally celebrating well before the final buzzer sounded.
Yeah, it is amazing, like, how dialed in they remain year after year, where winning clearly does not get boring to them. I know it's getting boring to the rest of the league, the rest of the fans, whatever, but this New York team is like as committed as ever, and you can see they just winning is everything to them. And Charlie Hoppus was talking about in the pregame press conferences as well. Like, it's hard to repeat as champs. And I know that's like, it sounds silly when talking about New York in that way, but you have to remember they do play a good amount of close games throughout the regular season. Obviously, DC has kind of been on the come up, still like nipping at their heels every now and then, and Philly took them to overtime this year. Like, yes, New York has dominated at championship weekend the past 2 years, but I still think they're so intrinsically motivated where they're not approaching it like this is a gimme championship. Like, they want to earn it, and they went out and did it.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I love you referencing that Charlie Hoppus moment from the pregame pressers. He was talking about a Pat Riley seminal book, Disease of Me, or maybe it's just a phrase he came up with. It was a part of like a larger memoir or something. But it's a great point. You know, you win these championships and all of a sudden there's kind of this expectation that the platter gets more full and there's more kind of food on the table, so to speak. And so people think, hey, I want to get a little bit more extra for me or for what I think that this team needs to do to win. And to your point, there's not that with this Empire squad. There is a selflessness. Mm-hmm. And we were kind of talking before we started recording about how in the past, in like the last three championship game appearances for this New York squad, it felt like a very heliocentric led charge. It was very star motivated. Yeah. They got good rotational player performances. But when you talk about 2019 Empire, it's Ben Yacht, Grant Lindsley, Harper Garvey, Jack Williams. When you talk about 2021, it was Jack Williams, Ben Yacht, Jeff Babbitt. In 2022, it's Jeff Babbitt, Jack Williams, Ryan Osgard, Ben Yacht. Excuse me if I'm repeating myself. This year, Babbitt was in the end zone a lot. Yacht got some deep shots from Ryan Osgard. Jack Williams had a fall down assist in the semifinals. But other than that, this was defense all day, every point in your face, making every single throw that an opponent had difficult and in their head. You just saw it from point one against Austin in the semifinals. As soon as the defense got a chance to take the field, you know, Austin started that game with two breaks. We'll get to that in just a minute. But there was just this wholeness to this 2023 Empire, right? There was this team-wide collective we talked about all season on defense. They've got two starting units effectively, maybe even 2.5 after this weekend. It just felt no matter how deep they reached into their tool bag, they were coming up with hammers to just nail down these opponents. I mean, it was suffocating. We talked about last year being the best defensive performance, we've ever seen a championship weekend when New York allowed 30 combined goals. This weekend, 29. You know, they outscore the offense 24 breaks to 21 holds on the weekend. They hold Austin to their second least efficient game of the season, only outdone by like a Tempest, Tornado, Texas Wind game down in that great state earlier in the season. And then they hold the best offense in the league to their worst performance by a country mile. And on the weekend, these two other teams, very good offenses in Austin and Salt Lake, combined 20 of 59 on offensive possessions, 34% efficiency rate. That would be 3 percentage points lower than the worst offense in the league this season. The New York Empire went out there and made two of the best offenses in the league look absolutely diminished. It's silly, man. It's not what's supposed to happen in these games. These are good teams. You know, the Soul and Shred should both be celebrating their seasons. This is building off of expectations, young teams making their first championship weekend appearances. And yet you look at these results and it's like, you got Donnybrook, man. Like they just tabletopped you in front of a stadium full of people and there's not really anything you can do about it.
Yeah. I mean, how much do you think though that it was just like the Empire's collective experience that they have on that roster in these big games, notably, like it was so clear. Like they just belong on this stage. And while of course Austin, Minnesota, and Salt Lake all belonged here and got there this season, there's just a different mentality when you know exactly what it takes. You're used to winning these big games and you know how to like rise to the occasion. I didn't feel that at all. Like, not even for a second, probably, from Austin or Salt Lake. Maybe Salt Lake a little bit in the Minnesota game, but compared to how they were playing for the entire season leading up to championship weekend, Austin and Salt Lake felt like two completely different teams this past weekend.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And so, you know, let's set aside all the superlatives for the Empire for the back half. If you're an Empire fan, you can skip to that half. Let's talk about and start with some game analysis, particularly the semifinal Friday. And so let's set up the first semifinal. The Soul get two breaks to start the game. And then I blacked out, and then it was a 10-goal win for the Empire by the end. I'm just kidding. The New York defense, you know, after the Soul kind of sees that momentum, got a whole bunch of our hopes up in the press box of, oh, man, is Austin going to do – no, no. There's no chance of an upset. New York – steamrolls after that point. They went on like an 8-1 run after going down those first 2 points or something.
I want to say it was a 10-1 run. If
it might have been 10. It might have been 10. I just remember by the time that buzzer sounded at the end of the first quarter, all of the oxygen for Austin's hopes had just like left the stadium. Like, it was just a romp. I think New York's offense, its whole starting rotation was without cleats on the sideline with like 5 minutes left in the fourth quarter or something. I mean, it was just done. Just absolutely kaput. So that was the first semifinal. Again, Austin did a terrific job getting here. They played their best ultimate in the South Division playoff bracket of the year by far in order to earn their first championship weekend bid. They come in with, I think, the right kind of mindset. I loved how Alex Atkins described it in the studio show, this kind of happy-go-lucky but delusional sort of confidence that you kind of have to take against the New York team, right? Like, you have build yourself up to say, no, we can do this. And, you know, to their credit, Salt Lake did it too. They thought that they played a good game back in week 12, and they went into their championship game thinking, hey, we can learn off of the mistakes we had in week 12 and build into this championship game match. But like you were saying a moment ago, it's just different here. And when New York's entire rotation is making their second, third, fourth, fifth championship weekend appearance, some of those dudes making four or five appearances in a row, it's just different compared to these Minnesota, Austin, and Salt Lake teams, excuse me, who had, I think, five or six combined players who had prior championship weekend experience. Four on three teams. You know, it's just... And you know, two of those in, Abe Coffin, Grant Lindsley, and Joel Clutton all had pretty darn good weekends, you know? Like, they went out there and they quit. Matt Armour, too, I should say, excuse me. You know, the players on these teams who had been here before clearly had that knowledge of that extra level you have to elevate to. Right. And it just wasn't quite there for everyone else, so...
Yeah, I mean, they're also, like, just thinking about Austin, so, like, they're so young still, too. It's, like, players that have not yet reached their primes. And so, like, even when you consider experience, like, with New York, it's experience, but it's also just, like age and, like, being talented veterans that are, like, in the prime of their careers. It still feels like Austin, Salt Lake are, like, on the come up, but this is just, it was just, like, a little too much too soon to ask them to compete with New York, I think.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, like, Austin actually has a couple of notable injuries. You know, someone we thought as being their best defender last year, Jake Reinhart, has missed this entire season. And it felt like, you know, they get these two breaks to go up early, and that is kind of the signifier for this whole team all season. And it just sort of gets muddled somewhere else in their offensive transition and just getting absolutely choked out by the Empire D-line all game. But that game aside, let's move to the second semifinal, the instant classic between Salt Lake and Minnesota. Okay. Once again, drawing on the Mark Lloyd rule of semifinal Friday or semifinal day. I guess it hasn't always been held on Friday, but Mark Lloyd once stipulated before the 2022 season, when New York kind of eliminated this rule for 1 year, that if one of the semifinal games is boring, the other one's basically guaranteed to be an all-timer. That held true on Friday night in the second game of the day between the Windchill and the Shred, going all the way to overtime, thanks to one of, I think, clearly the three best plays to ever happen in this league's history. And I'm, of course, we've waited too long to talk about it, the Joel Clutton tipped Hail Mary pass at the end of regulation to send this game into an extra frame. I mean, the amount of, I think, heady, athletic, right moment, right player sort of details of this entire sequence is just mind-boggling. I mean, first off, Salt Lake does a fantastic job of sort of weaving and, like we've seen all season, using the full width of the field to sort of shift and rock the defense back and forth, yeah, not necessarily giving away exactly where they're going to release that end zone attempt from. And sure enough, they kind of get the disc over to the left side of the field and then ratchet it all the way back to Chad Jorgensen to uncork. One of the more, I think, majestic and well-put buzzer beaters I've seen this season. Had a great amount of float, good placement on it too. It didn't have too much, and yet it had a lot of spin on it. So once it started to descend towards the pack, you get, I think, other than Jeff Babbitt and Jacob Fairfax, the clearest aerial athlete we have in the game right now in Joel Klutman, yeah, who hasn't quite shown it a whole bunch this season. He did have a buzzer beater block against LA in the West Division Championship this year, but compared to his, you know, Defensive Player of the Year runner-up performance in 2022, I think it's been right, maybe a little bit easier to forget what kind of monster this dude is in the air. I mean, there are what, like six players or so underneath of the pack when Clutton kind of comes in from the backside, sort of almost like swim move sidesteps into the pack, and then 2 foot bounces higher and faster than anyone else is even thinking of going up, and then gets basically to the top of a backboard level in order to even get a hand on that disc. The crazy thing is that he's almost looking eye level with the disc when he makes that Mac toward Elijah Jaime. It's just, he's silliness,
so,
man.
He's so high up, and he's the only one that's up there. Like, just the way he jumps so early, I think that's what he's so good at, is just knowing the full extent of his height plus jumping ability, where he can time it better than everyone. Like, in theory, the tallest guy should get the disc before everyone else if they time it exactly right. And that's what he did. And I just, I was fortunate enough to be photographing the game from the opposite sideline. The photos of that play, some other photographers were super close, but it's nuts. Just like the still frame of him towering over like as majestically as possible. And you know the outcome. Elijah Jaime catches it in the end zone. We think he smiles, right? Let the record show.
He denied it. He denies it. He denies all involvement in smiling.
He showed his teeth. I don't know if it was quite. I think it was a smile.
He bared his teeth. Maybe it's more of like a growl or a snarl or something.
Also,
like a, let's
the
go.
route he takes. We should talk about the Jaime route, because what, he was like around midfield when the throw goes up. He kind of like weaves over to get like an outside of the pile perspective, and then just perfectly times and reads the tip where it looked so easy, like watching it in real time. And from the opposite sideline, like I couldn't tell if it was like in, I kind of just like couldn't believe my eyes, because the Salt Lake was receiving the pull with like what, 15 seconds left after Minnesota had
17.6. So 17. We should set up the rest of this game after we get through this, you know, momentous play. I mean, it was an all-timer. It's hard not to put this as the headline of that entire game night, and maybe even the weekend. I mean, it was just, it was a moment, man. You had the Minnesota crowd going nuts, chanting defense. They were in it all night long. The wind chill played one of the best games of their franchise's history. I mean, it wasn't the cleanest, but they really brought down Salt Lake's offense to a more mortal realm and made it into a punching match. And that deserves all the credit in the world for this Minnesota team, an essential division that you and I and many people around the league have maligned all year long. We said this was going to be a down year. We said that, you know, whoever emerged from the Central, the chaos of the Central, you know, all the stuff and narratives we were building at the beginning of the season, who's going to emerge from this melee of the Central Division, this division that plays Big Ten football and doesn't play super pristine ultimate and kind of likes to grime it up with a lot of defensive looks. They went out there and they showed that they can take the most cleanly looking machine-like offense that has been on display all season and throw a big old monkey wrench right into the middle of the tread tracks and just make it into this brawl. And I just, it was, you know, as you and I have been talking about with people for the past couple of days, the last like quarter and a half into overtime too. It was just, it was exactly what you want from an ultimate game. Each possession having this sort of like knife's edge tension to it, of just any mistake matters and is magnified so much more. And you know, there were 38 combined turnovers in the game. It wasn't without its moments of variance, but there was this sort of, I don't know, like especially down the stretch, there was just this momentum to everything. Like both teams are just trading these kind of big blowout punches, all culminating in that Clutton tip.
Oh, I was just going to say, I kind of liked that the game was a little bit more turnover heavy than maybe we anticipated from Salt Lake. And like it was obviously wasn't the cleanest game for Minnesota, but that like added tension of every possession being that much more important late in games and knowing that anything could happen, like no team was a given to just like drive down the field and punch in scores. I feel like the super low turnover games obviously have their own tension where it's like, oh, is there going to be a mistake from either team at a given point? But given the frequency of these mistakes and just the defensive pressure we were seeing kind of develop throughout the game, that kind of like kept me on the edge of my seat. And I also think it kept the crowd super engaged throughout the game too.
Yeah, there really was a sense of you didn't know what to happen next with, you know, the kind of absolute moment again of that end of regulation insanity from Clutton. And then, of course, I feel like this always happens in a game like this. After that, the overtime was just kind of,
I have no recollection of overtime.
To me, I remember it was kind of both teams' fatigue setting in and just having to almost like crawl over the finish line. It was like at the end of an Ironman or something where you see the people's just nutrient levels deplete to a level where you're just trying to get over that line. I mean, Minnesota breaks to open it. Crowd going nuts. It feels like they might reclaim some of the momentum that Clutton absolutely ripped from them like a sky god. And then after that moment, Salt Lake holds. And then Minnesota, in basically 5 yards deep in their own end zone, commits a cataclysmic turnover from a player having a fantastic game in Tristan Vandermeertel, who is just, once again, you know, we talk about kind of the rotating team MVPs that have been a part of this win chill run all season. And the first kind of third to a half of the season, it felt like Sam Berglund and the pulling and the playmaking he provided the D-line. Then in the middle of the season, it kind of felt like Will Brandt or somebody started to take a little bit more of the helm. Tristan Vandermeertel deserves huge accolades for how he stepped up and played in a constantly shifting landscape. They put him on defense when they got a little bit more healthy towards a playoff run. They shift him back to offense for the semifinals game. He made a number of plays. And then unfortunately, just, you know, in the depths of like the 50th minute of this absolutely banana semifinal game, he makes a critical mistake. Salt Lake picks it up on the goal line, punches in a break, goes up one, and that's kind of it. You know, Minnesota had one final possession, but they were just gassed, man. Everyone on the field was gassed by that point. And to try to muster, I think, another buzzer beater attempt after what Clutton pulled off, it felt like once that second Salt Lake score got converted in overtime, even though there was clock remaining, that was kind of it. Like, Minnesota had withstood so many good punches and rallied back so many times, it just felt like they couldn't quite get up off of the mat there. Again, just a fantastic run for this Minnesota team all season. They came in and they played their game plan. Salt Lake just happened to be a better boxer in the scenario, kind of. And that's something that we didn't quite know Salt Lake was maybe capable of in this kind of environment. And so it's why they, you know, move on to a championship game appearance for the first time in franchise history.
Yeah, I mean, it was a super impressive performance, really, from both teams. I mean, the fact that Josh Klein was like a pretty late scratch for Minnesota, and that's why they had to shift TVM to the O-line. Like, I think the resilience and versatility that they kind of showed throughout the season as they were juggling rotations, like, what, they won 11 games this year? Is that right? Yeah, 11 games, 10 in the regular season, one playoff game.
Yeah.
Very impressive considering the roster turbulence that they had to deal with throughout the season. I feel like the semifinal game was kind of a good indicator of it didn't seem to matter who was out there. Like, they just have a very deep, talented roster, and they have guys that know how to play together. It was just, it was an unfortunate kind of running out of steam towards the end that Salt Lake pulled it away.
Yeah. And then kind of to be expected, Shred move on to the championship game, but after five quarters of intense ultimate in the semifinal game against a well-rested New York team. Again, the Empire just kind of blowing it wide open in the first quarter. Salt Lake made a run in the second, got within three by half, but
it was something.
Just given how the Shred offense didn't look like the unit we saw through the first 13 games of the season, it was hard imagining them overcoming any kind of fall behind against this Empire team. I mean, again, this defense just does not let you up. If you have any questions about what kind of caliber this New York defense is, it's just, it's irrefutable at this point. They are stacked at every single level. They've got, I think, you know, we can debate this a little bit. I think somebody who claimed the Defensive Player of the Year award out of Lucas Ambrose's hands and Antoine Davis. I mean, he took two of the best offensive players in the league in the biggest games of the years and made them irrelevant. Like, just wiped them off of the map, completely robbed them of their confidence in their playmaking, continually made the better play out into space. And I think it's just a culmination of what he's been building towards for several seasons now, right? Like, this is Davis's second championship with New York. It's his third overall. He's always been somebody who I think has absolutely thrilled any kind of viewing audience with his playmaking at times. I mean, you look back at 2021 when he led Atlanta in scoring, when he was just a dynamo on offense. But there's always kind of been this question about what happens in big games, what happens in these sort of smaller interstitial moments where it seems like, you know, all the confidence and sort of firepower that he can bring goes away somewhere. You know, the Dusty Green game against DC back in 2021, those sorts of moments. This version of Antoine is bulletproof, man. Like, he's just got it. You look at him on the field and it's nothing but confidence in his abilities. There aren't even flinches of moments of doubt anymore. And it's just, it's an absolute hats off to what he has been, I think, building towards as an individual and on this team for multiple years. And you look at the praises that his teammates have been saying about him leading up to this weekend in the post game, everything. They've been knowing this about him all season long. They've had to match up against it at practices. And they all just kind of, when you ask him about it, like, when did it click? When did Antoine turn into the person we've kind of all been touting? This person back when he won his first championship in 2017 with San Francisco, people were comparing him as a kind of young Bo Kittredge as far as his athleticism and playmaking and how it could potentially dominate individual games. And there's been these flashes, but now on defense, you see it, man. You see it because he just takes opposing best players and he makes them disappear. You know, they started to call it Davis Island. I guess, you know, the sort of messages in a bottle don't get received somewhere. People just end up becoming castaways on Davis Island. But it's just, it's next level stuff, man. He's a predator out there.
Yeah, I mean, he clearly evolved this year. Like, I don't think we've seen this level of defense from him, even for, like, little spurts. Like, I don't know. He probably had a few highlights within the past couple of years, but I mean, this was just like him imposing his will repeatedly. And I do think, I mean, there's a case for Antoine as Defensive Player of the Year, but I do think this was like him also leveling up for championship weekend in particular. And he's like so locked in throughout both of those games. Like, he's never, I mean, I think I'm sure he does have fun out there, but he's not like, he doesn't have like this cocky style about him. He's just like kind of getting the work done, but doing it at this super elite level. I do think Ambrose just throughout the course of the season constantly locked up and made plays against opponents' top players as well. Of course, it is always hard to compare West Division, East Division. You know, the New York has such a big team defense element too, where LA, you know, it felt like Ambrose was clearly like the playmaking defender for that unit. So that can kind of cloud judgment. But I mean, you know, it's not to take anything away from Antoine, obviously fully deserving of championship weekend MVP. And I'm glad he won it.
And again, we can save Defensive Player of the Year award debates for much, much later. But I want to talk about too, like, you know, Antoine was the star of this defense, but it goes so much more deeper than that. I mean, Brett and Tan,
yes,
my God, like, has to be the most underrated signing of the offseason. He was a coffin all weekend for opposing handlers. He had, what, 3 hand blocks in 2 games? He had a layout block in the semifinals. He had 5 blocks in the championship game. 4 blocks? 5 blocks? Somewhere around there.
Yeah.
And just
a foot block, too, at some points. He did everything.
Yeah. Him and John Randolph might be the best laterally moving defenders in the league, and they're on the same unit, and oftentimes trade off depending on particular matchups that they want. And it's just, you could just see it all weekend. These opponents would get bogged down in the backfield. One of the strategies we kind of talked about behind the scenes and with other coaches is that you want to try to pressure New York at least a little vertically, just so you get the disc out of turning it over in your own reset lanes. And New York just wouldn't allow it all weekend. And so then you're staring into the teeth of, you know, again, Randolph and Tan rotating, Josue Aloro having a fantastic weekend in the handler set, had a bookend score in the semifinals and just looked amped. Marquez Brownlee, fantastic weekend in coverage, weekend. You know, eating up discs into space, giving a little bit more of a size rotation into that handler unit, giving him another, you know, kind of frame to think about after getting some business from a Breton, from a JR. There's just, I think we focus so much on the size of this New York team, particularly on defense. You know, they had Babbitt back in the day. They shift over 2-time MVP Ben Yat. Jeff Holm is massive. They've just got kind of size everywhere. But you look at how they play handlers, Ben Katz too. There's something different about what they do to opposing teams at the point of attack that I really think needs to be like delved into. It feels a little bit like an evolution. I know it's ability of these individuals, but I also feel like it's system, right? Because there's just it's quicksand. You know, Salt Lake, they've sort of built this motor in the backfield all year that seemed a little bit impermeable. You know, you have 2 Jorgensens back there. Jacob Miller had one of the most precise seasons leading into championship weekend in the league history. They have this kind of fantastic ability to pivot from one sideline to the other, really off of that midpoint. And New York just didn't allow them to do that at all. Or if they did that, it was kind of a pitfall, and New York was looking for an Antoine blitzing block in the lane if they swung it out wide, or if they're congested, it's JR time, where he seems to have this spring in him to make plays in close quarters that just other people don't. It's just, I hate to just oversimplify it, but it's different. You just don't see this kind of consternation. Again, like, even in week 12, they couldn't quite do this against Salt Lake. They get another crack at it, and they completely blanket them.
Yeah, I don't know. It might be time to bring Cohen's Cuts back and just do like a full
season.
But I don't, like, am I going to
have
any
other... That's not what the fans...
Am I going to have any other takeaway other than, like, these players are just really good at what they do, and, like, they're so good at anticipating different block opportunities and getting the stall count high and knowing how to clamp down. Like, I don't know. You know, it's not some strategic... like zone matchup switching stuff. I mean, they do switch pretty well, but like, I just don't know how much you can go beyond like, this is a group that there's like so much trust within each D-line rotation and so much belief that like they can shut any of their individual matchups down and then they just do it. So I am curious though. I will dive in this offseason.
And honestly, we need to bring up the accomplishments of Ryan Drost. You know, he gets block number 199 and 200 in the semifinal game, becoming the first player in AUDL history to reach that plateau in terms of career blocks, only to be followed up by his brother, still at 198 all-time, Mike Drost just trailing him barely. And then the championship game, Ryan gets a Callahan, joining his brother also, who scored a Callahan back in the 2018 championship weekend. Two of the only Callahans really in championship weekend history of course, owned by the Twins at the top of the league's all-time block charts.
Although just, Kerr had one.
Yeah, no, it was a walking Callahan, though. There's been a few of those this year, but no, all credit to Jordan Kerr's semifinals Callahan. It's just so fun. You know, the Dros, once again, it's hard to even get to their name. They're the two best block getters in league history, and yet they've become, you know, obvious team leaders on the field and part of this whole historical legacy of the Empire. Mike joining in 2013, Ryan joining the following year in 2014 to the New York franchise. They've been here all along. They've been a part of what used to be known as the Faceless Mob Empire defense way back in the day. And it's felt like they've kind of kept that identity for themselves in this juggernaut of a D-line rotation, right? Like, sure, there's the Antoines, the Bretons, all the names you just read, and yet there's these old school, almost middle linebacker types of Mike and Ryan Trost who just continue to get it done and continue to read plays from the middle of the field at a level that not many other players are, and they're trending into their mid-30s, and it doesn't really feel like they're diminishing. They both had really productive years in 2023. When's it gonna slow down?
Never. At some point. It has to slow down at some point. I'm thinking, like, once these New York guys get to, like, age 40, that could signify the end of this dynasty. That's my current...
They're defenders! Thought. They're not a handler! Like, what are you talking about?
Okay, one lineup thing we haven't really talked about is the fact that they switched Jeff Babbitt and Ben Yacht back to their original roles, where Babbitt was playing D-line and Yacht was playing O-line at championship weekend. Do you think that mattered at all? It was interesting seeing Babbitt back on D-line, where it's like any time that D-line gets close to the red zone, it's like everyone's just waiting for Babbitt to break open. And he is like the guy that's going to score the goal every single possession. Not that it wasn't like that on offense for a lot of the season, but I don't know. It was interesting to me.
No, it's like YCC ultimate. It's like we know who our best player is, and we're just gonna funnel him at the cone every time in close quarter situations. So it's silly.
Yeah.
I mean, New York has the ability to swap over effectively two MVP level candidates depending on what specific style they are feeling in a given matchup. It's add it to the list of sort of unfair lineup adjustments that this Empire team can make. Basically at the drop of a hat. They played Jeff Babbitt as a 50 goal scorer all year and then said, hey, why don't you continue all the goal scoring, just do it for our D-line that's going to convert 24 of 36 break opportunities on the weekend, 67%.
Yeah, it was nuts. Lunacy, I also feel like we probably don't talk enough about like a defensive rhythm. I mean, I guess some teams kind of are able to go on break runs, but the New York offense this past weekend never really had the opportunity to get in any sort of rhythm because the defense was on the field so long. So it just became like defensive domination from the first point onward, basically, which is just, I feel like this is the first championship weekend in a while, at least in my experience, and my knowledge following the league, where it hasn't really been like an offensive showcase. And like in my theory is that offense typically wins championships in ultimate.
It's been the trend.
If you have the most efficient offense, like more often than not, you're gonna win. And it just makes sense. If you're holding the disc, if you're not turning it over, you're in good shape. But it was kind of cool to see the tables turned this past weekend, just see like a full-on defensive showcase.
I think this is the first time since 2017 that a team with a top two offensive efficiency rating didn't win the title. I think every single year, I can go back and verify.
I think it was 2015. It was the 2015 Spiders that weren't that efficient.
Oh, yeah. Like yeah.
Top five or something.
Yeah, no, it's 2015. Sorry. It's 2015 because 2016, Dallas led the league in offensive efficiency. Excuse me. 2017, flamethrowers were second. Yep, first time since 2015. So just another new trend for New York to pioneer by themselves going into the future. And, you know, we can talk about this probably ad nauseum all off season, but this is the start of a dynasty. Does it slow down? They're at 30 games. They win one more. They set the all-time record. They figure to return most of this roster next year. From everything this team has talked about, they are nowhere close to finishing this. What happens? Is this still just like uncharted territory of increasing gains for the Empire? Or is there finally going to be a moment where they look a little bit more vulnerable, particularly in these championship weekend formats where it just feels like, again, due to the experience and the talent, they're just at a different point than everyone else right now?
I think the only solution is DC to not let them get to championship weekend, right? Like that's
on you, DC.
DC's our only hope at this point. I truly believe that. I think DC is our only hope to prevent another New York championship next year.
Does New York now fully pivot into the villain? Do they have anyone outside of New York that's got to be an Empire team? I mean, I feel like this is approaching late 90s Yankees territory, where if you're any kind of casual observer, you're just rooting for and not New York. It was definitely that way a little bit in the stands on Saturday night, but New York brought a big contingent. You know, there was a lot of native Minnesota players on that Empire roster. Ben Yacht, Ryan Osgar, Charles Weinberg. I'm sure I'm forgetting a few more. They've poached from the land of 10,000 lakes continuously over the last few years. And so maybe that's a part of their secret success. You know, you need a former Minnesota athlete star to really win a championship elsewhere on the East Coast. You know, David Ortiz, Kevin Garnett, we can go on. Randy Moss, we can go on. Oh, no, Randy didn't win a title. I'm sorry. Anyways. Just another fantastic weekend for New York, and hats off to that organization. They've really worked towards this point, and I think it is incumbent on some of the rest of the league to figure out how to elevate to that level, because, you know, doesn't seem like they're going to be going anywhere anytime soon. Do you have any final thoughts about the weekend? Any last wrap up moments? We got to see a little bit of Joel Klatten on offense when Salt Lake kind of broke in case of emergency in the championship game and once again turned into just a deep threat monster when put in that receiving role. I just want to see more of that a little bit from Shred. I know that their offense has been so good and machine-like.
Yeah.
I like the way in which it morphs into a little bit more of a Hulk smash unit where they can just kind of hit a turbo button and go to Klatten deep.
He is super fun to watch offensively. My final takeaway is just the Minnesota crowd, and also being at championship weekend for the first time where the home team was actually in it. Like, that was just
you were not 2018.
I wasn't at 2018. Yeah, like that was just, it was like the coolest ultimate environment I've ever been a part of. It was the most exciting game I've ever seen. And yeah, just hearing like sometimes the different sections of Windchill crowd would have their own independent defense cheers. Other times there was like a smaller section of Salt Lake fans like chanting like "Let's go Shred," and then the other Minnesota sections chanting like "DDD defense." I just love the energy. I love the DeClercq towel wave to ignite the crowd towards the end of that game. It was really just like an incredible thing to witness from the standpoint of like a Minnesota team that most people viewed them as the underdogs going into this game. And I know I expected the Shred to win by at least a few goals, but for them to really rise to the occasion, play well in front of their home crowd and like use that fully to their advantage, even though they didn't end up winning the game. It was a sight to see. And that was an incredible game.
Held the previously top scoring team in the league to just 17 goals through the first four quarters. 17, because it was tied 17-17 after the Klatten tip pass. But it was the lowest scoring output for the Shred. And so again, the seven Minnesota defenders on the field plus that eighth in the stands. It was huge. Just short of magical, man. Like, it really was. I was in the press box above where the grandstand was, and you could feel the chanting in the booth. It was awesome. I only wish I could have been out in the open air and experienced a little bit more of the direct environment of it all, because I was, you know, behind the scenes doing a whole bunch of video. But again, we build for those moments. We build for a Klatten kind of encapsulation. It felt a little uncathartic not to get that kind of celebration from the home crowd and wonder what they might have brought into the franchise's first ever championship game appearance. But it doesn't seem like it's going to necessarily be the last attendance for Minnesota. Maybe not in the quite too distant future, the last time we will be in that state for championship weekend. But that still remains to be seen. TCO Stadium was obviously just a fantastic venue. If you were there, you probably agree with us. That whole campus is just next level, man. Next level. Nice. That'll probably do it here for us on Swing Pass as the last recap episode of the 2023 season. It's been a long road. I can't say enough about how much fun it is, and thanking Daniel and everyone listening to this. It's just been it's been a real pleasure of a season, man. It's fun. Like, I think that's another part about championship weekend. It's not only a coronation and a celebration of teams on the field. It's everyone's work in this whole league and putting it together. And it just feels so nice to have an event like that where we get a game like the second semifinal and we get such a deserving champion in New York, you know, too. It's nice. It's just a nice feeling after something like that. Yeah, sports are fun. Sports are fun. That's all I'm trying to say here. Sports are pretty fun.
Ultimate's a good one. I'll add that. I'll add that.
Ultimate is more often than not pretty freaking awesome. That'll again do it for this episode of Swing Pass. We'll probably be later back this week with another kind of wrap-up pod. Might try and get an interview. Don't want to promise anything. I know we promised a preview pod last Saturday, but Daniel and I got absolutely blitzed with work. We apologize for that.
Too much.
But true to our word, we will try to come up with something later this week, and we will be talking to you soon. And then we'll be trending into the off season where we can maybe do some new format stuff, introduce some new topics, get towards some end of the season award debates. Be really interesting. Even going into the off season, we're always keeping it fresh here on Swing Pass. We hope to talk to you soon rather than later. Bye now.